I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. In its 2014 State of the Bay report, out this week, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation graded the Bay's overall health a D+. Excess amounts of phosphorus, much of it from the Eastern Shore's chicken farms, continue to pollute the waters. Rockfish and blue crab numbers are on the decline. My guest this hour is award-winning nature and environment writer Tom Horton. He argues that uninhibited population growth is one of the biggest obstacles in the way of a healthy bay. The population of the watershed has more than doubled since the 1950s, and it continues to swing upward, 17 million and counting. A look at population growth, the Chesapeake, and the quality of life in our region with Tom Horton on Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with you every Monday through Friday from noon to 2 on WYPM, WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. Thank you again for making Midday part of your day. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation released its biannual State of the Bay report this week, grading one of the world's largest estuaries, actually the world's largest estuary, grading its health a D+, up from a D- back in 2008. Among the report's findings, excess amounts of phosphorus, largely due to runoff from the Eastern Shore's chicken farms, continue to pollute the bay's waters, and the populations of blue crab and rockfish are on the decline. What's more, the report said that the number of adult female crabs has dropped below the level considered depleted. The findings come as Maryland's governor-elect Larry Hogan prepares to take office in Annapolis, and he's hinted that he will take a different approach to environmental concerns than the state's outgoing governor, Martin O'Malley. Joining me this hour is the award-winning nature writer, environmental reporter for a long time, Tom Horton, an author of several books on the Chesapeake Bay. Tom Horton wrote a four-part series for the Chesapeake Bay Journal that examined the impacts of population growth on the health of the Chesapeake and the Chesapeake region. Earlier in 2008, he penned a report for the Able Foundation called Growing, Growing, Gone on this very subject of growth versus sustainability. More recently, Tom wrote a column for MarylandReporter.com warning of the environmental impact of continuous population growth on the watershed, which currently numbers upwards of 17 million people, up from 8 million in the 1950s. As I said, Tom is a longtime environmental reporter for many years with the Baltimore Sun. He's written a half dozen books about the Chesapeake Bay, and now he teaches in the Department of Environmental Studies at Salisbury University. He speaks from great experience and with solid authority on matters affecting the Bay and the quality of life here in the region. Tom, it's great to have you back on the show.
Good to be here, Dan.
Yeah, I remember the Able Foundation report from 2000. I just said 2008.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in that one, you examine this idea of continued growth versus the idea of sustainability. Remember, we talked about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been covering the Bay for 40 years,
yeah.
And we've been trying to clean it up for 40 years. And certainly, you know, a lot of battles won, but the war, as the Bay Foundation said this week, isn't going so well. And I have just become increasingly aware that we can't keep operating on this huge assumption that we can grow our way to a cleaner bay. And you could substitute a healthier planet for a cleaner bay. It's the same question worldwide. And I think most people kind of know we can't, but they operate on a couple other assumptions, that we don't have an alternative. And maybe that somehow we can learn to grow so greenly with so little impact that we can, as the economists say, decouple growth from the environment. It won't matter how many billions there are, we'll use less energy, not more. No one's really able to do that. That's kind of under the heading of faith-based economics or environmentalism now. So, you know, this conference that we're getting together next week at Hood College, Tuesday and Wednesday, is I think the first time anyone has ever in a formal way with a really world-class lineup of speakers raised this question and kind of challenged the Bay's environmental groups and environmental agencies to include growth in the conversation. I mean, to stop just assuming that we've got to grow and that somehow we'll make it so that growth makes the Bay better, not worse.
You know, it's interesting. We had a show about global population growth here a couple of years ago, and it seemed to be a niche group of scientists and people, demographers, geologists, people who, from all different walks of life, who have an interest in talking about that, but they don't see it translating. They don't hear the public responding and identifying that as the problem.
I think it's very hard right now for the public and a lot of experts to see another way. How do you change this? Certainly, there's nothing from our conference next week that's going to be packaged up for the legislature in 2015 or 2016. But I think our goal is really to change the conversation, to ask whether we really aren't just fooling ourselves thinking we can grow our way to a healthy environment.
What do we mean by sustainability on the other side before we go too far into this conversation?
Because
those are the things that are, you know, there's growth on one side and the idea of a sustainable economy, a sustainable way of life on the other side. What do we actually mean?
Well,
by
of course,
that?
I've heard some farmers say sustainable is making enough money to be in business next year, and for them that may be true. You know, I too often see articles on sustainability, even in very good magazines like National Geographic, that look at it purely in terms of how many people can we feed. And, you know, frankly, I think we could feed several times the number of people on Earth if we just wanted to feed people just survival. You know, we could skim algae off giant ponds and get enough nourishment. But Jesus, is that the point of life on Earth?
Right.
So I define sustainability in leaving room for all the parts of creation, nature, to flourish, the plants and animals, restoring where restoration is needed. And that's really a great divide, is whether you are human-centered in your view of sustainability, because then it pretty much comes down to how many of us can survive, and the rest of nature, you know, makes out for itself, and it's not doing too well, whether you're talking about the oceans or the rainforests. So, you know, and that's going to be part of this conversation next week over at Hood, is the anthropocentric versus the ecocentric.
I'll mention and give people some more details about that. This is a program sponsored by the Bay Journal. Is that right, Tom, the conference?
Yeah, the Bay Journal, the monthly paper that I work for and I'm on the board of, we're kind of hosting the conference.
Well, we'll give folks some more information about that January 13th and 14th as the hour progresses here. But it seems to me when we're talking about sustainability in terms of the economy and creation of jobs and it seems to me what we're talking about is a period that we're living in, a period where we have to repair the damage we've done, so to speak. You say in the piece that you wrote for the MarylandReporter.com, the 17-plus million already living in the watershed already need to reduce their environmental impacts by a large and expensive measure to avoid ruining this national treasure, the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing people sometimes tell me, well, if you stabilize population, why do you think that solves your problems? And it doesn't. If another person never moved into the Chesapeake Bay region today, we've still got an impaired bay. And, you know, and that's important because people sometimes think when I say the current program isn't working, that I mean that everything the Bay Foundation and groups like that are doing is bogus. Not at all. We would need to do all those things if growth were not an issue. Stopping growth, stabilizing population, stopping the endless economic expansion just gives you more options, gives you breathing room, lets things actually work rather than just keep your head above water.
Well, growth is a mantra, isn't it?
Oh,
especially in business.
Growth is good. You know, Baltimore Sun summed it up perfectly years ago in an editorial. Growth is good. Growth is necessary. Growth is inevitable. Take your pick. It's a good thing or you can't do anything about it. And add to that, we can get so smart that we can grow while the rest of nature actually is restored.
Why is it missing from the conversation? Let's just talk about population growth, for instance. Never mind economic growth, jobs growth, housing growth. Just specifically the number of people in the Chesapeake region, in the watershed.
Population's touchy for a lot of reasons. I find when I talk about it, people immediately think, uh-oh, he's going to start talking about forced abortions, sterilizations. How many people does he want to get rid of? I have four kids. Is he going to single me out and point a finger at me? You know, which is kind of ridiculous. That's not the way to do it. In the U.S., it's particularly touchy, Dan, because about 80% of our population growth is from immigration, legal and illegal, documented and undocumented, however you want to say it. So that gets into rather white upper-class environmentalists seeming to point fingers at not-so-well-off brown-skinned people and saying, out of our privileged country, you know, poor person. So you have to treat all these issues with a great deal of respect, but that's why environmental groups tend to avoid discussing population like the plague, even though over a beer at night they'll say, if we don't do something about population, all our programs are not going to amount to much. And we're going to get into these things at the conference because there are many proven humane ways to work toward a stable population. You know, there's a great little study published a few years ago that says if you had $1 million to decrease CO2, to work on climate change, how would you best spend it? You know what the top two or three are? They're not giving Priuses to everyone. They're not solar energy. They're educating women and children and providing global access to family planning, because nothing produces a lot of CO2 like having another kid. And that doesn't mean you don't have any more kids, but it means how many kids you have really, really matters if you're trying to repair the planet. And there are a lot of humane and proven ways to start moving toward a stable population.
Some people believe that we're in a period of such slow growth now, certainly economic growth.
Yeah.
That they may not feel it. They may not believe what you're saying, what you're suggesting. You know, 17 million in the Chesapeake watershed and growing.
Yeah, but you know,
definitely it's happening.
We're forecast to add about 1.5 million people a decade to the watershed. And yeah, if you pick a given month or even a given year, you can say growth is out of control, growth is not a problem. But I don't think anyone expects that trend not to continue. And a lot of that's going to be from immigration. And you want me to talk just briefly about immigration?
Yeah, we should talk about it because you're saying environmentalists don't like to talk about it.
Yeah, from the beginning of the nation till the 60s, we took on average a few hundred thousand immigrants a year, which in my lifetime has been somewhat close to the number of people that actually leave the U.S. every year, more or less in balance. Since the 60s, we have begun to take more through changes in immigration laws that, ironically, were not done to bring in more immigrants. They were done to make immigration more fair, more diverse, to get away from just Northern Europeans. Good things.
Mm-hmm.
But the unintended consequence was we're now taking legally somewhat on the order of 1 million a year. Undocumented is, you see lots of estimates, 500,000 a year. And then the new immigration reform bill, which has a lot of good things, like a path to citizenship, which I think is the only way to go for those undocumented already here. But it would actually increase legal immigration to 1.5 million, 2 million. And I guess personally, I would advocate moving back toward the historic rate of a few hundred thousand a year or something like that. That would be more or less in balance, because the people in the U.S. are pretty much near replacement rate, having about 2.1 kids per couple. So births exceeding deaths isn't really driving our population right now.
You write in your piece for MarylandReporter.com, which was published in November, who am I, lucky enough to have been born here, to say, in effect, that others keep out? Put that way, it sounds selfish, arrogant, undemocratic. Who appointed me gatekeeper?
Well, exactly, and I've had that question raised, you know, and it does kind of set you back on your heels because no one did appoint me, you know, and I have no power over this. But yet, what is the alternative? I mean, I kind of look back, when I was a kid, there were 8 million people living in the Bay watershed, and the Bay was pretty healthy. By the time I started covering the Bay in 1972 at the Baltimore Sun, we'd just about doubled that number, and the Bay was starting to crash. And, of course, it's not that simple. There were things with 8 million, like raw sewage running in the rivers, DDT, that were super bad.
Industrial pollution.
It's not just the number of people, but I have to think 8 million people does make a difference. And here we are headed, maybe within my lifetime, certainly yours, toward tripling the number when I was a kid. And we're taking your money at the environmental groups and your environmental taxes and telling you we're going to get to 24 million and the Bay is going to think there's still just 8 million.
Right.
It's going to return, because that's our goal, returning it to something like what it was when I was a kid. And that's a fraud.
Tom Horton is our guest in this hour of midday. If you'd like to join our conversation about the limits to growth and population for a healthy Chesapeake Bay, 410-662-8780 is the number for midday. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. Go ahead and send a comment or question by email. We'll read it on the air while Tom is our guest in this hour. And when we get back, I'll tell you about the conference he's been alluding to at Hood College coming up January 13th and 14th. A short break on midday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. For your information, that conference is called Growth and the Future of the Chesapeake Bay. As I said, January 13th and 14th at Hood College. You can register online to attend this conference and listen to the speakers. There's quite a lineup here, including our guest in this hour of the show, Tom Horton, longtime environmental and nature writer and author of Turning the Tide, Saving the Chesapeake Bay, and other books. You can register online at bayjournal.com. Look for information about this growth conference that's being held there. Are the impacts of growth projected over time really sustainable for environmental quality in the Chesapeake region? Many people say no. That's the conference January 13th and 14th. I'll mention it again during this hour. One of the speakers there, Tom, is Eben Fodor, author of Better Not Bigger, which goes back a ways, that book. I remember that book. He exploded some myths about growth.
Yeah, Eben's good. He is an Oregon-based consultant, but he grew up in Montgomery County, so he knows the Bay. And, you know, he takes head-on these notions that if we don't continue to grow, we will not have the money to solve big societal problems, unemployment, poverty, affordable housing. And what he's done is he basically finds that those are indeed not true. He has done a very good study where he looked at the 100 biggest metropolitan areas in the U.S., and he looked at the fastest growing and the slowest growing. And what he thought he might find was a correlation. The fastest growing areas were doing the best reducing poverty and unemployment, providing affordable housing, and would have the highest per capita incomes. He found no correlation with any of those, and in fact, with per capita income, a negative correlation. Doesn't make sense, but he would be the first to say his study raises more questions for study, but the fact is, growth just doesn't do these things. You can do these things, but growth is not the way.
We assume that it's going to create jobs, right? If a new company moves into Maryland, into Frederick County, it does create some jobs, but it creates jobs for people who don't live here.
Well, that's one of the things
Fodor found, right?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, it does create jobs, of course. If you develop a mall, it creates jobs. People move in from outside, often temporary workforces. The unemployment level is really not much affected, and the poverty level. Same with affordable housing. You know, you will hear developers time after time say, if you don't let us build more and more houses, the price of housing will go through the roof. Turns out if you want to create affordable housing, there are a number of specific programs, subsidies, incentives you can use, tax credits, but just growth it's a meat axe approach. It really doesn't work. You also have to look at what kind of houses are they building. Not many of those developers are building affordable houses.
Also, the government plays a role in this.
Sure.
Talk about that a little bit. You point out in the piece you wrote for MarylandReporter.com, environmental agencies included, from the Environmental Protection Agency on down, the growth that drives it is actively sought by every level of government. Those agencies seek to restrict pollution.
Sure.
That is a result of growth. Yet you say, while the growth that drives it is actively sought by every level of government. So government, including the EPA, is supportive of growth?
Yeah, you know, sometime between the 1950s and the 1970s, the role of government became more and more narrowed to growing the economy at ideally 2.5-3% a year, you know, on average.
It's the primary theme of most people who seek public office,
it
seems. Right?
It's good to remember that was not the primary goal of government for the first couple hundred years of the U.S., and only really since the 70s, to the point now that even if the Baltimore Sun writes about the opening of a new art gallery, it generally is slanted on how it will boost economic growth, how it will bring in money, tourism, and all that's fine to mention, but we look at everything through the lens of economic growth, as if nothing else mattered, you know, civic pride, better schools, better health.
General quality of life.
Quality of life, yeah. So yes, that is the prime directive by which government rises or falls. And not surprisingly, we make overmuch use of something called the gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure. If you see in the Sun or the Washington Post, GDP up, gross domestic product, that means we're growing 2 or 3%. GDP is an interesting animal. If you have an oil spill, it drives GDP way up. It did with the Exxon Valdez. Actually, more than if it didn't spill, because GDP just counts everything, paving, building, cleanup, anything that generates dollars.
Emphasis on cleanup.
Well, it does not subtract anything for loss of nature, anything for oiled birds. So GDP can give you a very skewed measure. It makes growth look a lot better than growth should.
For many years, and even through the recession, the financial collapse, the recession, and after that, and still today, housing starts are considered a measure of how well the economy is doing.
Well, because a lot of our economy in Maryland, too, is based on that. And, you know, that raises another point. If you right now, if people think when I talk about a non-growing or steady state or ecological economy, that I just mean taking the current economy and grinding it to a halt. That would be a blooming disaster, because it is an economy geared to growth, new housing starts and so forth, paving and cutting and filling. You're really talking about a fundamental transformation of the economy, one that would not be built around consuming more and more natural resources.
Well,
and you can't do that tomorrow.
Let's go to sustainability for a minute, just on housing.
Yeah.
Because I've thought about this. Because the idea of housing starts, more housing starts, kind of gives me and a lot of other people in Maryland a chill when you think about how much more land can we take up? How many more houses can you build? How many more wells can you drill? Okay.
Yeah.
So I always think, okay, sustainability on the other side of that is fixing up old houses, reinvigorating old suburbs and the urban core, the centers, like Baltimore City or other smaller cities.
Well, that's another interesting thing. When you talk about a Maryland that wasn't growing, there are parts of Maryland that it would be good to grow. Baltimore City is built and sewered and paved and designed for the better part of 1 million people, and it's got, what, less than half that now. So, yeah,
it's got 620,000, something like that.
If you were to stabilize Maryland's population tomorrow, I would still want to get another few hundred thousand people back into Baltimore, you know, and there are other places like Baltimore, perhaps Cumberland, Crisfield, so forth. But, yeah, so it you know, nothing's – anybody who says they've got simple answers to our problems, I wouldn't have them on your show more than once, but
His a comment from Stephanie writing in. Tom, maybe you want to respond. Stephanie says, growth is fine as long as there is planning. California does a much better job at planning for growth. Back in the 70s, California enacted anti-growth land use regulations and created natural preservation areas. Santa Barbara, for instance, is a no-growth city.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of what makes California so nice right now, but it's also frustrating and creates scarcity in housing. Just be smart about growth, she says, and give us more mass transit, please.
Well, smart growth and mass transit is sure better than sprawl and more interstates. But one of my speakers, Herman Daly, who founded the science of ecological economics, which is economics as if nature mattered too, Herman often talks about loading a lifeboat. He said, you know, if you use a really good planner and computer assists to load that lifeboat, you can put a lot more people in it than if somebody who isn't good at planning does it. But he says, you know, at some point, that boat still sinks. It's on the bottom smartly instead of dumbly. And it takes a while longer. And this is the fallacy of smart growth. It's not that smart growth is a bad thing at all. We should do it much better than we are. But you're still growing. You're basically going to hell slower. And that is really the fallacy, I think, of thinking you can grow greener and greener. Of course you should. It works up to a point, and then you still sink.
That's very interesting. Ecological economics is what Herman Daly, that was the title of one of his books.
Yeah.
Recently, when I wrote a column about Larry Hogan's position on the new poultry manure management tools that the O'Malley administration put in place in October, November. And the new governor vowing to overturn them, making this a priority of his new administration. Some people wrote into The Sun, letters to the editor, pointing out that I had missed a greater point about how this might be seen as being good for business, the pro-business position of Larry Hogan, the Republican governor-elect, to come to the aid of poultry farmers who feel these rules are too tough. But there's a greater economy tied to the Chesapeake Bay, not just watermen. It's recreational people who use it for recreation, for fishing, or just live near it and have property values based on the quality of the water and the view of the water. So that gets to that. That's all part of that equation. And that's why when we get to these poultry regulations, it's important to look at that, the larger picture here.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I don't want to get too far afield here, Dan, but you know, I was reading that Sun article, very good article, about the need to put phosphorus management in the context of its harm, if we don't do it, to a much more valuable bay.
Right.
That's a good way to argue up to a point, but I get nervous about putting everything, as we do these days, in terms of dollar value. Yes, the bay is valuable. Yes, we should treat it as part of the economic picture. But, you know, at some point, I really believe that if we don't put this argument on at least somewhat of an ethical, moral basis, in addition to just whose dollars are out-dollaring whose other dollars.
Right. Whose interests is
I think nature loses big time, and we eventually lose big time. And I don't mean economically. And we're going to have some speakers who get into that. That's not primarily the focus of this conference. But if we just because what if somebody came along with a plan that outdollared the value of the bay? It's not inconceivable.
What do you mean?
Well, this is going to screw the bay, but it's going to generate 10 times the money for people. I mean, which I think would probably force most of us to say, but there's more than dollars to the bay. But we don't say it enough.
Here's a comment by email from Patrick for Tom Horton. The population problem in quotes, is often reframed as an attack on populations in low-income countries. How do you address those arguments? Well, that takes us back to immigration, and I'm glad you brought it up today, but it does seem to be elephant in the room, pardon that use of that phrase, but that's sort of what it is, right, when it comes to environmentalists talking about the future.
Yeah. You know, the population movement, and I hope we bring this up at the conference next week, population movement probably needs to learn more about how their message of stabilizing population comes across to various parts. For example, there has been a serious breach with feminists who have come to see it as a bunch of angry old white guys blaming women, couching everything in terms of reproduction and so forth. And we won't get into that today. It's a breach that needs to be healed. So I bring that up because of your caller saying, are we blaming people in other countries with higher growth rates?
Right.
And that's an issue that needs to be addressed with a lot of respect. I like to think that we can talk about it and do things about it without any blaming. But, you know, I do think that we spend way too much time arguing over how many immigrants we should take in the U.S., and not nearly enough time looking at all those U.S. policies from agriculture to the International Monetary Fund lending that keeps crushing economies in less developed countries so that they are guaranteed to keep sending a steady stream of immigrants somewhere. I think taking more immigrants in the name of diversity, a good thing up to a point, can be a fig leaf for liberals who don't really want to get into the ways we could really help those countries not send so many immigrants to the rest of the world. And that would include access to family planning, but also agricultural and lending policies that right now favor big U.S. companies and crush third world economies. And we don't talk enough about that because it's hard and complicated. Easier to just say, I'm for diversity, increase immigration.
Longtime environmental writer, reporter, nature writer Tom Horton with us in this hour of midday as we talk about one of his favorite subjects, growth and the future of the Chesapeake Bay. That's also the name of his conference coming up January 13th to 14th that Tom has put together with the Bay Journal. You can register for the conference again at bayjournal.com. More with Tom when we get back. If you have a question or comment about sustainability versus growth here in the Chesapeake region, 410-662-8780 is our number. This is Midday. Hey, Tom, we got a tweet with a question about your upcoming conference at Hood College, January 13th, 14th, on growth in the Chesapeake. Gary tweeting in, will conference materials from sessions be available online after the conference?
We are taping the conference. I think the best thing would be to check the Bay Journal website, which cost you nothing. In fact, if you want a Bay Journal mailed to your home, you can get that free, too.
We tell them every time Rona Cabell comes on the air.
Yeah. So we are taping it. We will plan to make whatever we can available on our website and perhaps including the speakers' PowerPoints. That's going to still be negotiated with some of the speakers.
Here's an email from Elizabeth with a question for you, Tom. She says she understands your viewpoint and agrees about growth. However, most of Maryland is not raw nature, but farmland. It is my opinion that farmland is really the greatest threat to the Bay rather than development. Could Tom comment on this?
Yeah, it's a good question because farmland is by far the biggest source of pollution to the Bay. And why wouldn't it be? It's the biggest land use in the watershed by far. The natural question, what's population growth got to do with farmland? But what it has to do is regionally, globally, the more people, the more demand for food, and the more intensive the use of farmland. You know, Elizabeth, is it?
Yes.
we had more land plowed under for farming 100 years ago in most parts of Maryland than we do now. And yet the bay was healthy. So what gives?
It's true for most of the East Coast, right?
Sure, yeah. Probably most of the world. Yeah. But what's happened is the intensification of agriculture, more fertilizer, more chemicals, higher yielding crops, more crops per year, no land lying fallow. So as population increases, as the economy grows and people demand more food, better food, richer diets, we use farmland harder, and it becomes harder and harder to control the pollution. I mean, witness the expansion in the last 50, 60 years of poultry, from backyard flocks to industrial strength poultry farming, even if they are on family farms, and mountains of manure that we have not done a very good job of disposing of, so runs in the water. So there's a very definite close link. In fact, just to give you an example, we probably went backwards in recent years on agricultural pollution and keeping forests around the bay because America's stupid ethanol policy to grow grain to make fuel, which gives us about as much energy as it takes to produce it, that boosted cropping of corn around the bay so much that it offset a lot of the hard-won gains farmers had made on reducing pollution. So just agriculture and world demand for energy for food very tightly related to population.
Before, when we were talking about sustainability, I mentioned it seems like we're in a period of repair when we have all these needs because of damage done over the years to the environment. The Chesapeake is the most obvious example right here in front of us. You see another report from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, another D. This is a D+. In the past, it's been D-. So I was wondering, when it comes to poultry, I just want to talk about this a little bit more. When you talk about a period of repair, a period of cost, more expense to live on the planet, to live where we do, because of the cost of things. You see this in the General Assembly's raising of the fee for stormwater remediation.
Sure.
Right? More people, more impervious surfaces,
more
stormwater.
A lot of that is bills past due that we're trying to make up for in a hurry. Yeah.
Chicken is still a pretty good buy compared to other forms of meat, other protein in the market, right?
We've pursued a cheap food policy in this country. It's pretty popular. And if what you want is the cheapest possible food for the most people, good luck to the rest of the earth, you know, and of course we are making concessions now. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be more expensive for food and things like that if we do right by the environment. It shouldn't be outrageously more expensive, but it will be more.
On the specific topic of poultry manure, right, and what to do about that, and the phosphorus that results from that, the nutrient that gets into the bay that causes all these problems, causes eventually dead zones in the bay.
Yep.
I was talking to someone who sat on the Fisteria panel. Remember when Fisteria?
1997, 98.
You covered it for The Sun, probably.
Yeah.
There was an outbreak of this Fisteria in some tributaries of the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah.
There was a panel formed by the governor and some experts brought in to examine that subject. And one of these gentlemen who sat on that panel told me that if for just a few pennies more, you could, on the cost of chicken, price of chicken, that consumers could probably have chicken with more environmental integrity than we have now. That you could probably cart away a lot of that manure with full of its phosphorus, or you could do manure to energy plant, which is supposed to be happening in Maryland. There are solutions. Sure. It was just there's some cost attached to it.
There are solutions. And, you know, what the chicken people will tell you, and I know a little about this because my dad was a poultry processor, and I was too for a while out of college. So I grew up in the industry. It's a very competitive, internationally competitive, where profit margin is tiny, tiny fractions of cents per pound, and you make it up by running huge volumes of chicken. So, you know, a couple cents a pound can be a big thing for someone in the chicken business. But up to a point, you know, people like Purdue already charge you more per pound because they've been successful in making you want a Purdue chicken. So you do that now. Up to a point, I think poultry producers could absorb a bit more expense to take care of manure. They should. It's part of producing their product. But they are very mindful of the international competition. In an ideal world, taking care of the phosphorus from poultry, it isn't an Eastern Shore, a Shenandoah Valley thing. It's a national thing. Everywhere they raise chickens, they're doing this.
Doesn't this get us back to sustainability,
yeah,
Tom?
Yeah, theoretically, we got an EPA that creates a level playing field in all areas of the country that grow poultry. The reality is sometimes somewhat different. In Mississippi, EPA is different than EPA around the Bay. They shouldn't be, but they are.
If you want to sustain the production levels that we have,
yeah,
and even grow, I'm sorry to bring up that word, but it seems to me that when we talk about sustainability, we're talking about dealing with that in some way,
yeah,
right? I mean, creating an economy that addresses that problem almost.
Sure, and you know there are some solutions. I think most immediate is this large power plant that would burn poultry manure that Maryland is working on. They've kind of fumbled the ball. It should have been building now, and it's not. But that could take half of all the poultry manure fairly quickly
and create energy.
And it would have some subsidy. In other words, somebody's going to be paying for this, you, me, the chicken people.
Well, in this case, in Maryland, Exelon Corporation put up, $75 million or
Exelon
something.
Exelon put up the money. It was part of their takeover of Constellation, created some funds. And, you know, there is an element of the environmental movement who wants to stop such plants, figuring it just enables what they see as an egregious industrial animal operation to go on forever. Now, I think the reality is you're not going to make big chicken choke on its manure. You're just going to keep it going in the rivers. Politically, they're quite powerful. So I think... And I wouldn't want to build a manure-burning power plant if it couldn't meet the strictest Maryland air quality regulations. I've been told it can. We'll see.
Tom Horton is our guest in this hour of Midday. We'll take a couple of calls as soon as we can for Tom. I just want to ask you this. How do you keep from getting depressed about all this?
You know, I find maybe the best antidote is hanging out with younger people. I'm teaching courses every semester in environmental studies down at Salisbury University. And, you know, a lot of my students are just too young and dumb to know all the things I know can't be done. And that's probably a good thing.
We need their idealism.
Yeah. So,
but you see it, huh?
I do see it. And it's maybe I give them something, but they give me quite a bit.
So they haven't given up. Yet.
No, they're too young and dumb.
They're not
to give
jaded
up yet. Yeah, they're.
Let's take a couple of calls for Tom Horton here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Hilda in Frederick County. Hilda, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I would like to ask, and I was a farmer's daughter many years ago. We have gotten rid of, I guess, 40% of our farms up here. We're for roads, bypasses, and such. And doesn't that eliminate grass and bushes that would filter some of all of that waste that goes to the Chesapeake? I've not heard the gentleman mention that.
You know, you raise an interesting and complex question because in the narrow sense, I think most developers could honestly tell you, let me come in and develop a farm and I will guarantee you a net reduction in the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus leaving that site. That's assuming they did an environmentally sound development. Now, that's if you look at it in the narrow and the short-term sense. In the bigger sense, those people in that development don't just sit there. They buy second homes in Ocean City. They demand more roads. They demand more services. They generate a lot of pollution in a lot of ways, just being people, not being bad people, just being people. So, you know, to say we could probably, if we had a program to develop our farms right now, get a short-term reduction in narrowly defined water pollution. In the long term, we'd not only lose a lot of the ability to feed ourselves, but I don't think we'd gain anything from that development because it has a lot of impacts, some of them not very well documented on the streams and rivers, and we're finding out more about that. But it's not a real simple answer, Hilda, and but I don't think the loss of farmland. I also think we can learn to farm considerably cleaner than we are now. We'd better.
Here's Jen in Baltimore with her question. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom Horton and Dan. This is Jen in Baltimore. Tom, you know me from way back when I tried to stop the Loyola Stadium from going into Woodbury Woods.
Oh, yeah. Jan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
hi.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, they've cleared another bunch of acres and are putting in tennis courts. Well, they're being very responsible. I haven't really made my peace, but they're going to be putting in all native plants and trees.
Are they going to put in an equal amount to what the tennis courts take up, or twice as much sometimes?
You'd have to look at the plans. But my main reason for calling is, do you remember Stan Edmister?
I do remember you introduced me to him once, yeah.
Yeah, back in that little tiny area of Woodbury up at Cold Spring and Green Spring are 9 homeowner-occupied houses. Maybe 2 of them are rented, but they're mainly occupied by the homeowners.
Mm.
And a development proposal came through to the city back in the spring of last year that we accidentally stumbled upon, and it took a long time to finally sit down and find out what was going on.
Jan, listen, we're short of time, so is there a question you can ask Tom about that?
The point is, Baltimore's fighting for a greater tree canopy with many organizations.
Oh, yeah, there's some good groups in that, yeah.
To throw in 14 to 17 housing units in an area where we have just blocks away blighted properties, vacant,
yeah,
abandoned, and we also have over at Rotunda 382 apartment units being built.
No, I agree, and you're no matter how well you do and site those new houses, if they're in existing forest, you're going to lose. You may not lose a lot, but you'll degrade the quality of water.
So the idea there is people want to live in the city, but they want the bucolic setting they might find in the country.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, if you go up, take a satellite picture of Baltimore, you have all this abandonment, all these open spaces, or at least deteriorated housing. If you were to tear them all down, you'd have large open spaces in Baltimore that could be converted into a different kind of housing. We don't have to have row houses constantly, but that's infill. Tom.
And here's the other thing. We're going to spend millions of dollars trying to repair and restore city streams, and we'll never connect it really to the building of those 17 new houses, nor will they pay any money for that. And that's, again, we're trying to get across the need to really more accurately look at the costs of growth, because we think growth is not going to look that good if you really get the accounting for it right.
What did you think of the ridiculing of the stormwater fee as a rain tax?
Oh, you know, I got to admit, that was a catchy phrase, a rain tax.
Sure.
But
if you're opposed to what, though? You're opposed to a new fee, having to pay more money for living in this damaged environment that we live in?
Well, it's, we tax your poop. You pay a water and sewer bill,
right.
and everyone accepts that. That's not a thing anyone enjoys, but you have to pay for that, and you have to pay when you pave, even if you're a church.
There is a registration fee for the panel discussions and the 2-day conference that we were talking about.
It's $100 and for the 2 days, and a student rate of I think $20 or $25.
$25. It's on the BayJournal.com website. The Growth Conference, Growth in the Future of the Chesapeake Bay. Our guest in this hour, midday, Tom Horton, is one of the guests there, January 13th and 14th again at Hood College. Tom, thanks very much for getting here.
Yeah, thanks
nice,
for having
nice
me.
Nice to have you on the show. Thank you very much. Tom Horton, we'll see you again soon. Please stay tuned for the news, folks, and then we have the second hour of midday.